The opening talk was on, well, the partly on the basic ingredients and one of the aims of the Satipatthana meditation, and yesterday's talk was on 14 qualities from the Metta Sutta, the discourse on loving kindness, for a person, or 14 qualities that a person should put it and possess who wants to attain that state of peace. Now, today, tomorrow, and the day, most likely the day after tomorrow, we shall continue to build a good foundation for your meditation practice. And once all the main points are there and you have a fair understanding of how to do the practice, then the practice will kind of take care of itself. Now, today we shall, or for the next 3 nights, we shall explore a passage that frequently recurs in the text at different places, and that has to do with the gradual path of training. Now, all of us here as meditators, we are undergoing such a training in Satipatthana, and when we practice Satipatthana, then the meditation will unfold along a gradual path. Now, the way that the Buddha describes this gradual path of training that a disciple or a meditator undertakes covers the following main stations. And the very first one consists in hearing the Dhamma. So either by listening through or to a discourse, or by hearing a friend speak in praise of the wonderful qualities of the Dhamma, or by reading a book on the Dhamma, or maybe participating in a discussion, and so on and so forth. Now, with this very first hearing of the Dhamma, and hearing is to be taken in a wider sense, including reading, with this, then some faith may arise, or will may arise in the Buddha himself, namely the Enlightened One. And this initial faith is just a starter, and it is still rather weak. Now, initial faith in the Dhamma may also arise in a different way, namely simply by seeing a Buddha statue somewhere, be it here or in a monastery, or at another person's house, or in one of the Asian countries. And so there are a number of people who've been just very much impressed by the serenity of the Buddha's facial expression, as often depicted on statues. Now, this initial faith, and the Pali term for faith is saddha, then leads to right thought, namely samma sankappa in the Pali scriptural language. And this right thought then unfolds along the line of, well, clearly seeing the disadvantages of leading a householder's life and not being able to practice the Buddha's Dhamma in full. In part, yes, but in full it might be somewhat difficult. And thus seeing the disadvantages of the household life, one might decide, one hears about some upcoming retreat, and then one might decide that on a temporary basis one is going to renounce one's circle, one's family, one's circle of friends and acquaintances. One will make the necessary arrangements with regard to one's job, and then one will join such a meditation retreat. And so in order to practice the Buddha's Dhamma in full. So all day long, and observing the precepts to the best of one's ability. Now, these first two steps of the initial arising of faith, and then followed by thoughts of renunciation, nekama, will or might then lead a person to then also voluntarily accept and observe a certain ethical code of conduct. And this in the Pali scriptural language is known as sila, and today, one of our main points that will cover the silas in greater detail. And one sees the benefits of the sila, and thus one makes every possible effort to maintain the purity of or in one's bodily and verbal conduct. Now, this observance of sila usually leads to the arising of happiness. And happiness that results or then comes from the purity of one's conduct. However, things don't end there, and another major phase on one's gradual path of training consists in the practice of contentment, the development of contentment, as we've as was mentioned already last night during the talk on the 14 qualities from the Metta Sutta. And so the next phase on the gradual path of training that the Buddha describes consists in the practice of the restraint of the senses. Indriya Samvara Sila, which is actually also an aspect of Sila in a wider sense. And tonight, and time permitting, we shall also elaborate more on this. And then the Buddha goes on to describe the development of one's training along this gradual path by saying that the disciple takes up the practice of mindfulness and clear comprehension, so sati and sampajanya in the Pali scriptural language. And so this certainly then also includes, or as a further step, one selects a proper place for one's meditation practice. And the Buddha then, very realistically speaking, goes on to describe what happens next on this gradual path of training of a disciple or of a meditator. And the next step consists in the arising of the five hindrances. And these hindrances in reality do occur, and they do cause the meditators a fair amount of trouble. However, they're there to be overcome, and it's not impossible. And then when working with some predominant pain, and also again and again working with the hindrances, trying to overcome them, concentration will improve, and eventually those hindrances will be suppressed. So the Buddha says that concentration, samadhi, is, or the development, the arising of a certain amount of concentration is another major step. And once a meditator has overcome the hindrances and then goes beyond them and develops his or her practice further, and then very soon will he or she understand that formations tend to be subject to the three universal characteristics of impermanence, anicca, of unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, and lacking a self, namely anatta. So what this then marks is the very beginning of vipassana in a strict sense. The Pali term vipassana can be broken up as vi and passana, or pasati. Pasati means he or she or it sees, and then the prefix vi means in various modes. So one sees, one understands in various modes, namely in the modes of anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And so this then marks the arising of genuine vipassana wisdom, or insight knowledge. Now, as a meditator then keeps on contemplating the predominant objects as they occur in the body and in the mind, and oftentimes under the aspect of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, and then gradually, after much practice, a meditator will reach liberation, and as the Buddha points out, even full liberation. And then such a person might utter words such as, "Forever am I liberated. This is the last time I am born. No new existence waits for me." So these and then mark the major steps along the gradual path of training of a disciple or of a meditator. Now, tonight, let us explore to some extent some aspects in connection with virtue, sila, since this concerns all of us. Now, to start with a story. And not just some invented story, but a real story. It so happened that last year I taught a Vipassana retreat in Israel, a 10-day retreat, and one of the talks was on Sila. And I prepared this talk a lot and put much time and effort into this talk. And then the talk was over, and then maybe a half an hour later, three quarter of an hour later, all the volunteers and myself, we met for the usual evening get together, discussion of latest development of the retreat, and then the person who was chairing the evening, our evening get together, he announced, and the topic of our social gathering tonight is your presentation of the Dhamma talk on Sila. So then I thought, oh my goodness, what is going to happen now? And then there were three among a group of maybe 10 or 11. There were three who were really adamant and finding faults with the talk. And I had put so much goodwill into it. I'd given the talk, I would usually give it in Lumbini, and not very different from how Asian teachers would give it. Now, the presentation as given in Israel would have been perfectly okay in Burma, but apparently not in Israel. So, this then led to a number of reflections and reconsiderations and so on. Now, when pondering, I discovered a definition of the term sāvaka. Now, sāvaka literally is a Pali term which means listener. And so, the Buddha defines a disciple, or actually the literal translation is a listener, but the wider meaning of the term is a disciple. So a disciple is one who listens. And then the Buddha goes on to specify this further by saying, it's actually a noble and mindful listening to the teachings of the Buddha. And remembering that definition was helpful, namely when it came to this infamous talk on Sila. Now, when listening to a talk, whatever the content may be, a talk on Dhamma, then we should, as the Buddha points out, set aside all sorts of concepts and ideas and certain beliefs or ideologies. And obviously, as the reaction showed after that Dhamma talk, there was a lot of, at the time, there was a lot of resistance to the presentation of the talk, and maybe, I suppose, also to the content of it. And that then led to an exploration of the possible reasons. Now, in the different religions, we have a code of ethical conduct. So within Christianity, those are, as all of you will know, the Ten Commandments, and then In Buddhism, it's the sila, and then in Judaism, it's the mitzvah, which regulates the relationship between God and human beings, and also the relationship among human beings. And it certainly governs many things of the religious life of the believers of Judaism, such as certain rules concerning the Shabbat and the preparation to the Shabbat, and so on and so forth. And apparently there are more than 600 ethical rules altogether. Now, in Hinduism, if I'm not mistaken, some ethical rules or rules concerning ethics can be found in the Patanjali Sutra, and in Islam, I don't know. Does any one of you know the relevant text there?
In the Quran, there are many directives in terms of charity and morality.
Okay, so the Quran. Do you have any more specific texts than that? Any chapters or so? Anyways, and so what this then leads us to is that an ethical code of conduct can, of one sort or another, can be found in all major religions. And then, upon further reflections, I found, well, there is certain, obviously, these days, also certain code of ethics for physicians and for nurses. And so then it appears that even some big corporations that now are talking about and implementing a certain code, ethical code of conduct, and so even some politicians try to stick to a code of conduct. And in 2006, well, it was the year of the World Cup, and so then I heard that even the FIFA, the governing body of football for the entire globe, has an ethics committee. And so I was very pleased to find out this. And then at IMS, Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, which is maybe the leading meditation center, the Vipassana meditation center in this certain country, there exists a committee by the name of Ethics Committee, which then watches carefully over the conduct of the meditation teachers, the ethical conduct of the meditation teachers, and also staff and the meditators. Now, thus then shows that a certain ethical or to live by certain ethical code of conduct, after all, isn't certainly that strange, and is not necessarily only limited to a particular religion. And sometimes people respond negatively to a talk on Sila because it might remind them of memories or experiences from the past as a child when some religious man or woman, male or female priest, would tell the congregation, please don't do this or don't do that, you should this or that. And this may cause some reactions. And then, as part of Christianity, talk on ethics oftentimes evokes thoughts about sin and going to hell, and so that is then strong or attached with some negative thoughts and emotions. Now, in the meditation practice, a certain degree of self-discipline is necessary. And it may seem like a paradox. By curtailing one's own freedom to do or the freedom to say whatever one likes, in the end one gains a far greater inner freedom, namely vimutti in the Pali scriptural language. And this then is known as the freedom from the mental defilements. And so we may think that externally we are free beings, namely free in the sense to do or to say, like we have the freedom of speech, we have this freedom of work, and the freedom of movement, and so on and so forth. Yet, internally, we tend to be enslaved to the arising of the mental defilements. And so, when a mental defilement has arisen in the mind and it's quite strong, then we act usually. If we don't meditate, we tend to act on it. So the meditation practice leads to a different kind of freedom, namely freedom from mental defilements. Now, when it comes to an ethical code of conduct and its observance in the context of Buddhist meditation practice, then these ethical precepts should not be seen as some commandments handed down by some supreme being, but rather these are proposals given by the Buddha that in the end lead to our own and others' happiness. And they prevent us from causing harm to ourselves and to others. Now, virtue or sila has been defined in different ways. The Dhammasangani, which is the first Abhidhamma work, defines it in the following way, namely, as virtuousness is not transgressing in action, not transgressing in speech, not transgressing in both action and speech. And the Venerable Jnanatiloka, in his Buddhist dictionary, defines virtue as a mode of mind and volition, namely nacetana manifested in speech or bodily action. So the way we keep our mind, the way we let our minds well behave or work or operate, this will then have a tremendous influence on our bodily and verbal deeds. And remember that the very first Dhammapada verse as recorded in the Dhammapada and uttered by the Buddha is the forerunner of all things, or the mind is the forerunner of all things. And so before we do something, before we say something, there will be some mental intention of either positive or negative nature. Now, the Visuddhimagga defines virtue or sila in the usual classical fourfold manner. And so, this is actually quite helpful. Namely, it says that the characteristic of sila is composing. Now, with this term, you, or when, upon hearing this term, you may not understand what is meant. The first meaning of the word composing, sila, is as coordinating, and the second meaning is as upholding. Now, coordinating, samadhana in Pali, means that one's physical and verbal conduct will be coordinated or is coordinated in accordance with virtuousness. And so, this then means that there is a non-inconsistency of one's physical and verbal conduct owing to virtuousness. Now, many people in our modern society are not necessarily living according or living in a truly virtuous manner. They tend to be more opportunists. And in the presence of some government certain body, will they behave according to the law? And in the absence of some governing body, when no one else can see, they may do or say things that are not necessarily in accordance with the laws of the country. And what we then have is an inconsistency with virtuousness. Sometimes virtuousness is there, at other times it's not there. And so, thus, the first characteristic of virtue in the sense of composing is that our behavior will be coordinated according to or according with virtuousness. Now, the second meaning of composing is as upholding. And sila is said to uphold since it serves as a foundation for profitable or wholesome states to come. So, when our bodily and verbal conduct is virtuous, then it means, as we shall see later on, the mind will be free from remorse and a bad conscience. The mind will be free from the agitation caused by remorse, and as a result of this, it can concentrate well and easily. And so, thus, concentration becomes a possibility, and with the mind well concentrated, one can then penetrate the most predominant object of observation and thus know its nature. Hence, in other words, the practice of virtue or the training in virtue leads to the further training in concentration, which in turn leads to the arising of wisdom. And hence many wholesome mental states arise in connection with wisdom. But if there is no concentration owing to some breach of the ethical code of conduct, then remorse will be there, there's no concentration, and then wisdom cannot arise, and with it also wholesome mental states cannot arise. Now, the function of virtue is twofold and pretty obvious. The first one is the action to stop misconduct, and the second function of virtue is the achievement of the quality of blamelessness in a virtuous person. And the manifestation of virtue is given as simply as purity, namely bodily purity of one's bodily conduct, and then the purity of one's verbal conduct, and later on, in addition with the training and concentration and wisdom, then also comes the purity of mind. But please do keep in mind that with the observance of an ethical code of conduct, we can only cultivate our physical and verbal deeds, but not our mental deeds. So you can observe as many precepts as you like. The unwholesome mental states may still or will still arise in the stream of consciousness. So we need to go further, deeper to change that. And the proximate cause for the arising of virtue is given as the pair of conscience and shame here. And conscience is explained as the awareness of right and wrong. Now, the Buddha distinguishes two forms of virtue, and there are many other ways to classify sila. And he says there's virtue as keeping or observing, which is one, and the other one as avoiding, virtue as avoiding. The first one is known in Pali as charita sila, whereas the second one is known in the Pali scriptural language as varita sila. Now, virtue as keeping or observing has to be understood in the sense of the Buddha recommending, well, don't do such and such thing. And so, thus one then knows this instruction or rule, and then one observes it, one keeps it. And the second form of virtue is that as avoiding, and the Buddha made to our benefit, or the Buddha has certainly given to our benefit a number of instructions. Well, stay away from maybe an act of taking life, since this is going to bring harm to yourself and to the being involved. And thus this then this certainly we or when it comes to such an instruction, we then avoid any kind of or any act of taking life. Now, the Visuddhimagga points out, with regard to this twofold virtue, that the first one, namely virtue as keeping or observing, is accomplished by faith and also by energy. Whereas the second one, namely virtue as avoiding, is accomplished by faith and mindfulness. So let's start with the second one. By developing more and more mindfulness, we become more and more aware of our intentions, of our thoughts, and then it will be easy to spot some unwholesome thought or intention that, if we're not mindful, might otherwise certainly lead to a transgression of a certain ethical rule of conduct. And as for the first one, observing or keeping, this is being, or is said certainly, is to be accomplished by faith and certain energy or the effort. Now, when the Buddha recommends that we should preserve life as much as possible, then we have faith in the validity of this statement, and we then also make the necessary effort to protect life. So, as a practical example for this, let's say you find suddenly you're going to wash your face, and you find all sorts of ants and other insects crawling in the sink. Then, what do you do? Well, and then you don't just open the water and flush the insects away, thinking, never mind, they know how to swim. But rather, then you say, you think to yourself, well, let me make a big effort here, a concerted effort to preserve the life, the lives of these tiny little beings here, and then you blow them away, or you find ways and means to remove them from the sink. Now, the practice of virtue has a deep, deep meaning, namely that it leads in a general sense to a reorganization of our deeds, to a reorganization of our bodily deeds, to reorganization of our words or our speech, and to a reorganization of our thoughts. And so, with regard to our thoughts, this covers not just sila but also other aspects. And there, in working towards liberation, towards knowledge and liberation, we need to make certain changes. Otherwise, it will not work. Now, the Buddha has given an illustration for all of this. When we want to dye a piece of cloth that already has a certain color, and on top of this is somewhat dirty, then we need to purify it. We need to clean it. And we need to remove all the stains, and then remove the old dye. And then only can we dye this piece of cloth in a new way? Likewise, in our concerted effort to work towards knowledge and liberation, we need to purify what is there. And this then covers our, or this is, then applies to our bodily deeds, verbal deeds, and also mental deeds. And the observance of a code, ethical code of conduct, usually very much helps a person to avoid any kind of excessive egocentricity, always thinking only of our own good and not sudden taking into consideration the goods or the well-being of others. Now, the Buddha has said that, or has mentioned a number of benefits with regards to sila. And the first one, the most simple way of expressing this is in a conversation with Ananda, the long-term attendant of the Buddha. And Buddha says, virtues are profitable, or they're wholesome. They have non-remorse as their aim, and they have non-remorse as their benefit. And this is a quote from Anguttara Nikaya. Now, the Digha Nikaya, volume 2, section 86, mentions five benefits in connection with virtue. And the first one is that one who is virtuous, possessed of virtue, comes into a large fortune as a consequence of diligence. And before explaining this particular benefit, let me explain the remaining four first, and then the first one will make much more sense. Now, the Buddha states as the second benefit that a fair name will be spread about a virtuous person. And after a while, people will recognize that such and such a person is a virtuous person, and that he or she does what the person says, and says what he or she does. And so certain or integrity is there, and certain people recognize this. And certain accordingly, they will then mention this to others and say, yes, you can work with this person. This person is a really reliable and virtuous, honest person. Now, the third benefit as given by the Buddha for a virtuous person is that such a person enters an assembly without any fear or hesitation. So, if you've lived a virtuous life for many years, and you simply have not transgressed in any way, then you will most likely not have enemies. And thus you can enter any assembly, any meeting, any conference without having to fear to meet some of your suppliers, which you otherwise, or in the case of a non-virtuous person, whom you have not paid yet, or maybe you've done something terrible, and then you go to some meeting or some assembly, and here the first person to meet or the first person you meet is some law enforcement person. And the fourth benefit that the Buddha states for a virtuous person is that a virtuous person dies in an unconfused manner. Now, this needs some explanation. See, as we go through life, we accumulate all sorts of deeds. We do partly wholesome deeds, partly unwholesome deeds, and when we approach death, these things, or some of our deeds, the major ones, come up apparently in a quick review. And so if we've spent our life as a butcher, having slaughtered hundreds of animals, then most likely some image in this connection will come up. And so, not only this, but also, according to Buddhist Abhidhamma, a nimitta, a sign of the realm or the world that we're going to be reborn into, such a nimitta or sign will also arise. So if one has, if a butcher has slaughtered plenty of animals, then it might very well happen that the person sees some ominous sign, like many animals. And this could be taken as a sign for rebirth in the animal realm. And so, this then leads to a confused state of mind. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, death is an extremely important point in the life of a person, and we need to work towards it throughout our living existence. And then the Buddha gives as the fifth benefit of sila, namely reappearance in a happy destiny. So it leads to some favorable rebirth. Now, when you think of the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth benefit of leading a virtuous life, then you can see that this indeed leads a virtuous person to gain a large fortune, not necessarily in terms of money, but in a different sense. Now, in the connection with the second benefit, that a good name spreads about the person, the following Dhammapada verse is there. Dhammapada verse 56. And there it says, "The scents of rhododendron and of sandalwood are very faint, but the scent or the reputation of the virtuous is the strongest. It spreads even to the abodes of the celestial beings." And furthermore, in praise of virtue, the Buddha also says, as is recorded in Dhammapada verse 217, "He or she who is endowed with virtue and insight, who is established in the Dhamma, who has realized the truth and performs his or her own duties, is loved by all." And Dhammapada, another Dhammapada verse well known and oftentimes used to represent the essence of the Buddha's teachings is Dhammapada verse 183. Sabbapapasa akaranam kusalasa apasampada upasampada sacitam periodapanam etam buddhana sasanam, which means not to do evil, to cultivate what is wholesome, to purify one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Now, the virtue or the Buddhist virtue in the form of the five precepts can be said to be applicable not only to meditators during a Satipatthana retreat, not only to Buddhists, but to all beings, irrespective of all human beings, irrespective of their denomination. And thus, the five precepts represent a certain, universally valid morality or code of conduct. And they lead to the benefit of those who are observing them. And as mentioned already and during our opening talk on the 6th of July, that being or leading a virtuous life is or brings about a certain adornment. Now, there's also a beauty connected with the ethical code of conduct. Namely, in the sense that it leads to mutual trust, it opens doors, and the caterpillars and ants and flies and other bugs say thank you for not stepping on them and for not swatting them. And sila leads, and that leads to a respect for life in general. And the Buddha has praised virtue in many different ways, and maybe the last such way for tonight is recorded in Dhammapada verse 110, where it says, better than 100 years in the life of an immoral person, or a person who is unethical, who has no control over his or her senses, is a day in the life of a virtuous person who's not just virtuous, but on top of this, just like all of you, who cultivates tranquility and insight meditation. Now, sometimes we may not exactly know whether it is proper or not proper to do something, and then the Vinaya, the monastic code of conduct or sila in general, recommends that we simply follow the following yardstick, namely taking oneself as a yardstick and putting oneself in another's place. One should not beat or kill others. So in a wider sense, putting oneself into the shoes of another to whom one may is considering to inflict some harm in one way or another, one then quickly realizes that one will not want to suffer from such a transgression, and just like oneself, one is afraid of the stick, one is afraid of death and any form of punishment, so too others are also afraid, and others also cherish life just like we do, and thus voluntarily one refrains from such a deed. Now, just to give you an example of how the Buddha expresses or has expressed some of these ethical rules. Now, in the context of taking life, the Buddha says, a meditator fulfills the rules of of a meditator. Literally here in the text it says of the monks, but this also applies to non-monastics. So he or she avoids killing of living beings and abstains from it. Without stick or sword, conscientious, full of sympathy, he or she is desirous of the welfare of all living beings. Now, what we have here is not just an expression of what one should not do, but also the positive aspect of protecting and preserving life is there. And like the Buddha says, desirous of the welfare of all living beings, full of sympathy, full of compassion. And the same approach then is taken with regard to all of the other precepts. And maybe to give one more example with regard to wrongful speech and then cultivating wholesome speech. One avoids lying and abandons and abstains from it. One speaks the truth, and one is devoted to the truth. One is reliable, worthy of confidence, no deceiver of men and women. One avoids slandering or backbiting. One abstains from it. What one has heard here, one does not repeat there, and so as to cause dissension. And what one has heard there, one does not repeat here, so as to cause dissension. But rather, one tries to unite those who are divided, and those that are united, one encourages. Concord gladdens the person one delights and rejoices in concord, and it is conquered that one spreads by one's words. So again, what we have here is first to abstain from unwholesome speech, unskillful speech, and then on top of this, the encouragement to develop wholesome speech. Now, maybe this much gives you an idea of virtue. Of course, there would be much more to say, but we simply don't have that much time. Now, just briefly, connected with sila or virtue in a wider sense is also the restraint of the senses. In Pali it's known indriya samvara sila, namely purity or purification through the restraint of the senses. And this restraint of the senses, as outlined at the beginning of the talk, is part of our gradual path of training, and it fulfills a very important role. Now, the Buddha, in praise of this restraint of the senses, has uttered the following two Dhammapada verses, namely 360 and 361. Good is restrained over the eye, good is restrained over the ear, good is restrained over the nose, good is restrained over the tongue. Good is, this is now verse 361, good is restrained in the body, good is restrained in speech, and also in thought. Restrained everywhere is good. The monastic or lay meditator, restrained in every way, is freed from all suffering. Now, when it comes to this restraint of the senses, we need to distinguish between the following two terms, namely the general appearance of an object and its particular features. Now, the general appearance of an object is given in Pali as its nimitta, and the particular features are, or this is known as anubhyanjana in the Pali scriptural language. Now, to give you an illustration for this, the form, when one sees some object that has two legs and a trunk and arms and a head, and seeing this would then qualify as the general appearance, the nimitta. And then seeing the particular features of that object, such as its nose and it is shaped in a certain way, or to see the way the person is walking, this then is more specific and thus known as anubhyanjana. Now, in the case of a lack of restraint of the senses, we at first see its general the general appearance of an object, and then later on we may also see the particular features of that same object, and so in both cases it may lead to the arising of some unwholesome mental state. Now, with regard to the restraint of the senses, the Buddha has given or has stated the following, namely, and this is as recorded in the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta 39, paragraph 8. Bhikkhus or meditators, you should train thus. We will guard the doors of our sense faculties. On seeing a form with the eye, we will not grasp at its signs, namely nimitta or general appearance, and its particular features, anubhyanjana, since if we left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade us. We will practice the way of its restraint, we will guard the eye faculty, we will undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. And then, on hearing a sound with the ear, it's the same thing, and so on and so forth. And then the Buddha goes on to say, now, bhikkhus or meditators, you might think thus. We're possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Our bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct, and livelihood have been purified. And we guard the doors of our sense faculties. That much is enough. And you might rest content with that much. Bhikkhus or meditators, I inform you, the Buddha says, I declare to you, you who seek the recluse's status do not fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. So, we should not limit our practice to just the practice of the restraint of the senses. Now, when we do practice this restraint of the senses, then the mind will not suddenly be unnecessarily agitated through the bombardments through objects. And thus the mind will be tranquil and still, and with such a tranquil and still mind, it will be relatively easy, or it will be easy to develop concentration. And a certain sense of ease will arise, and this ease in turn will then lead to the arising of concentration, and this will then contribute to the arising of wisdom. However, the case is different for one who does not practice restraint of the senses. Now, usually the sense door process operates in a particular manner, namely that there is first of all the arising of an object. There's first contact, fassa, and this then will be followed by a feeling, and this then will lead to a perception, and this may lead to the arising of a thought, of some associative thought, vitakka, and in one case it may lead even to a whole proliferation of thinking, papancha in the Pali scriptural language. Now, a second case in the when it comes to the absence of or lack of restraint of the senses is that there's first contact with an object, so the mental state of contact is there. This then produces or leads to the arising of feeling, vedana, and then when the feeling is pleasant, it may and then it will lead to a perception, and based on the pleasant feeling, then craving and clinging, upadana and craving, tanha, and certain clinging, upadana, may arise. And so it's kind of like a predictable course of action. And in the case that the object is undesirable, then the whole cognitive process will be accompanied by an unpleasant feeling, so dukkha vedana, and this then may lead to the arising of a sense of dejection or aversion, ill will, and so on. And so in all three cases, the lack of the restraint of the senses leads to some unwholesome states. ranging from mental proliferation over craving and sudden craving and clinging, all the way to the arising of aversion or ill will. Now, as a meditator, we need to go against the stream, and we need to work, even though there is again and again a great temptation to look around whenever one hears the sound of some unique bird or special rare bird. And even though there is this temptation, yet one needs to resist it. Normally, a person would simply just look at the object, and under normal circumstances, there's nothing wrong with this. Now, to give you a very practical illustration for how a lack of the restraint of senses, namely asamvara, indriya asamvara nisila, what this does. We're practicing here at the Vallecitos mountain refuge, and then one day some young and charming and good-looking young man and woman come walking into the meditation, into our meditation the location here. And so a meditator who is not guarding over his or her senses will discover these two young people, and then if oneself is a male person, one might take much interest in the young woman that is coming along. And if one happens to be a female meditator, then one might take much interest in the young man that is coming along. So at first one sees just the general appearance of these two people. One recognizes these are two human beings while they're still at a distance, and then as they come closer and closer, and as one sees the particular features, one then gets interested and can't get enough looking more and more and more. And usually it doesn't end there, and what one has seen, then one takes to one's sitting meditation, and while sitting patiently on the cushion, the mind goes off into all sorts of directions, and sometimes even fantasies arise. And so obviously with this, the mind is then not pure anymore. Thus, the restraint of the senses really helps to prevent unarisen, unwholesome mental states from arising. Now, to conclude today's Dhamma talk with a story that is mentioned in the Visuddhi Magga, namely in the connection with the restraint of the senses. And I'm quoting from Visuddhi Magga 1, paragraph 55. It seems that a certain elder by the name of Mahatissa was on his way from a place called Chetyapabata, namely the mountain of stupas, and apparently an area where there were many monasteries at the time. So he was on his way from Chetyapabata to Anuruddhapura, an ancient, very famous Buddhist site in Sri Lanka or Ceylon. And he was on his way to collect alms. And at that time, a certain daughter-in-law of a clan who had quarreled with her husband and had set out early from Anuradhapura, all dressed up and tricked out like a celestial being, to go to her relative's home, saw this monastic venerable Mahatissa on the road, and being low-minded, she laughed a loud laugh, wondering what is that. Wondering what is that, the elder looked up and, finding in the bones of her teeth the perception of foulness, he reached arahantship right then and there. And then it was said, he saw the bones that were her teeth and kept in mind his first perception, and standing on that very spot, the elder became an arahant. But as for the husband who was going after his wife, he saw the elder on the road and asked, "Venerable sir, did you by any chance see a woman?" To this the elder then said, "Whether it was man or woman that went by, I noticed not, but only that on this high road there goes a group of bones." Let me conclude tonight's Dhamma talk by wishing, may you have that restraint of the senses as practiced by Elder Mahatissa, and being well aware of your very first perception. May it lead all of you, me including, to the final goal, namely full liberation. And this is it for tonight. Good. Since it's already 8 o'clock, so tonight we won't have a question and answer session. We can maybe have our first question and answer session tomorrow after the Dhamma talk.